You're listening to KRBS 107.1 FM in Oroville, California. The program you're tuned into is Left Turn on Bird Street. Thanks for joining us today. This is our second hour. Our program is heard every other Saturday from 9 a.m. to 11 a.m. Thanks for joining us. And we're continuing the interview we had in our first segment with John Burton, an attorney and political activist from Pasadena, California. And John, are you with us?
Yeah, I am.
Okay, great. The line sounds much better, by the way. So maybe, who knows, maybe the NSA was listening in on us. One can never tell these days, can we?
We knocked them off the line.
Well, Aretha is still with me.
Oh, is she? Okay, well, let's make sure, you know. That's okay, though, but we don't want to disturb you, because if you're going to listen to us or listen to Aretha, you're liable to listen to Aretha, because she's certainly more entertaining than us. But thanks for joining us today. And, you know, during the break, we had a call on our line from somebody listening on Live 365 from Hollywood, California.
We made the big time.
We made the big times. Tom Talon agents are listening to us in Hollywood. Anyhow, Mark has a question for you, John, and we can't. We can only accommodate one line. So Mark would like to know. First of all, he wanted to say he's really intrigued about your party policy and if you could elaborate on that. And he also asked if you could elaborate on why the Democratic Party has grown so incompetent. So, Mark, thanks for the question. And, John, would you like to address that?
Sure, I can give it a stab. In terms of our policies, I tried to discuss that earlier. In terms of why the Democratic Party has become so opposed to the interests of the working class, we would say that it never really was based on those interests. The Democratic Party has a history that goes back to Jacksonian period before the Civil War, and has always been somewhat of an alliance between Northern political opportunists with some sort of populist bent and Southern racist and slave owners. The Southern racists moved from the Democratic Party to the Republican Party as part of the Southern strategy implemented by Nixon during the 1960s, but it still maintains its roots in a section of the financial oligarchy which believes, in sort of the Rooseveltian tradition, that some sort of compromise is necessary for social stability, but still ultimately the interests of the financial oligarchy trump the interests of the working class. So that's what the party is historically. Today, with the growing financial crisis, the loss of global hegemony by the United States economically, to emerging economic powers like China and India, the Democratic Party, like the Republican Party, is standing behind a policy of shifting the burden onto the backs of the large working population rather than on the financial oligarchy, which supports it.
Well, I've been thinking and saying that I don't think it's really incompetent. It's just doing things on purpose that they excuse as incompetence, when in fact they're doing it intentionally.
Well, I think it's we hear a lot in the mainstream media about politicians having ideas and this idea and that idea, and the Democratic Party doesn't have any ideas. We don't view things that way. We view politics as a conflict of different interests. And what interest is a political formation speaking for? We on the Socialist Equality Party claim that to speak exclusively in the interest of the vast majority of the working population, the working class. And the Democratic Party speaks on behalf of conflicting interests, those of financial oligarchy. Their contention that they represent working people is a fraud. And it's a fraud to a certain extent being perpetrated with the assistance of trade union bureaucrats who have long ago stopped fighting for the interests of their membership and subordinate them to the Democratic Party in exchange for a certain sort of privileged social position of their own within American capitalism.
There's one area I wanted to ask about, going back somewhat to the party, or actually to the party, is that the website, WSWS.org, is available in German, French, Italian, Russian, Polish, Serbo-Croatian, Spanish, Portuguese, Turkish, Sinhala, I think that was, I always thought that was Sinhalese, but Tamil, and Indonesian. That's pretty international. And I've read on the site that it's been active in Sri Lanka. Can you give us an idea of the international scope? What countries is it most active in? Are there any office holders for the party in different countries? Can you put a frame around the party itself?
Sure. We consider ourselves to be the continuation of a long tradition of an international party that dates back at least to the founding of the Fourth International by Leon Trotsky in 1938. We do have sections around the world, including in the former Soviet Union, Germany, England, etc. We have a very long-standing and very active section in Sri Lanka, which I don't believe they have any office holders there right now, but they do stand in elections and have a very large following. We're seeking to develop new sections and new contacts around the world all the time and are, in fact, succeeding in doing so.
Well, you know, actually, my first connection or view of the Fourth International in this. There was a movie many years ago in the 60s, black and white. David Warner was the star. It was called Morgan. I don't know if you've ever seen that.
Oh, that was with Lynn Redgrave, right?
I think she was the romantic interest in it, but there was also the mother, I guess, was I don't know her name. It was a very interesting movie, and he would go to he and his mother would go out to the cemetery outside of London or in one of the London districts to where they have a Karl Marx is buried, and they have a bust of iron of him. That so inspired me in the whole concept that when I did go to London, I went out to that cemetery and sat for a while just looking at the bust of Karl Marx and wondering, boy, this is something. As I was doing that, a bobby came by and sort of glanced over me, wondering what I was doing, because there I was, doing nothing.
Kind of a suspicious-looking character, Tom.
Is there a particular place, a particular immediate goal that we haven't already addressed that for the party or for the movement that you want to mention?
Well, we're focused right now on the extremely protracted and difficult task of developing socialist consciousness within the working population. You know, our goal of the SAP in the United States is here, but of course it's an international question. And I'm very touched by your reference to Karl Marx and his cemetery. We are unashamed and unabashed in our declaration that we are the continuity of the great scientific achievements of Karl Marx and his great collaborator Frederick Engels in the 19th century, who uncovered the inexorable laws of capitalist development and who, I wouldn't say predicted what would happen, but who uncovered the tendencies that inexorably worked themselves through with capitalist development. We need for people to understand that the problems that they face are not the products of the Bush administration, despite, you know, its criminality and the buffoonery of its leader and his intellectual deficits and the criminality of people like Cheney. That's not the fundamental problem that they face. The fundamental problem that they face is embedded in the nature of the social relations that underlie U.S. and world economy. And until they come to grips with that and understand that those social relations have to be changed, that society has to be reorganized so that this incredible technology, these wonderful productive forces that humanity has developed, can be used for the benefit of the population as a whole rather than to generate profits for a sliver of the population, until that lesson sinks in, genuine political progress is impossible. So that's our focus, is to bring that fundamental conception to as wide a layer of the population as we possibly can.
Well, as we mentioned earlier, my theory that people coalesce, a movement coalesces behind a leader, and sometimes there are several leaders around the movement. Is there some person, some place that people should be looking to exemplifies what the SEP believes in? Is there, even if it's in Sri Lanka, is there somebody we can watch that you think is thinking right and is getting someplace in the direction that you want to be?
Well, we think that our website, the WSWS.org, is what people should be watching. I mean, it's accessed all over the world, and it explains on a daily basis our Marxist analysis of what we consider to be the fundamental developments. And I can't say we have, you know, state power anywhere, because we don't. And the closest that our movement has come to state power was in 1917, when the Bolshevik Party seized power in Russia. But I think for people who want to watch, and for people who want leadership, I would say over and over again, look at WSWS.org and our archive of material. I'm sure there's something there that would interest every listener.
Yeah,
we have scientific articles, we have cultural articles.
Yeah, but that's my problem with it, is that the website is theory. And in fact, people really need a person or something physical that they can follow. Going at a website, you have to read it and think about it and come to a conclusion. And thinking and coming to conclusions is something we've already talked about, the public in the United States at least having a tough time doing. When they go to bars, they don't talk theory. They go to have a beer over what some guy did. And so that's what I'm fishing for, is some person, like, you know, a football star. They follow football stars. They don't follow the theory of football.
Well, I wish there was some shortcut. I can understand your impatience. A lot of people express that to me. But our party believes, based on long historical experience, and including some very difficult and tragic periods that we ourselves have passed through over the years, that there is no shortcut, that the only way forward is through the development of socialist consciousness within broad masses of people. Once we have that, they will understand what needs to be done, and our party then will be able to provide the leadership and develop the leaders to accomplish that. But again, we're not a cult of personality. We don't have infallible leaders. We're not opportunists. We're not looking to have somebody who's famous in one area or another to short-circuit what is a historical task that has to be done right, otherwise it's not worth doing at all.
So basically, people are going to have to take the long way home.
Well, there is no other way home. That's our opinion. And I hear this all the time. They say, well, yeah, this is all well and good for the future, but we've got to get Bush and the Republicans out in 2006, and the only way to do that is to support the Democratic Party. My answer to them is as long as the population stays wedded to this corpse of a reformist party, the Democrats, then there's going to be no progress. There simply is no shortcut here historically. That's our position. And for people who agree with that, they should contact us.
You're listening to Left Turn on Bird Street on 107.1 KRBS, Oroville and Oroville, California. Thanks for joining us today. We're interviewing John Burton of the website WSWS.org. So go ahead, Tom. I just wanted to make that brief announcement.
Okay. Now, I've been hogging the mic. It's your turn.
Okay. So what are, you know, I hate to put a time frame on it, but what are your near-term goals in terms of your website and how will you be able to measure your success? Do you have any sort of measurement of how well your word is getting out, John?
Well, yes, we're very successful. As I said earlier, our website is far away the most popular on the World Wide Web that deals with socialist policies. And we have a tremendous regular readership, and it grows all the time. This is very easy to track through this modern technology that measures hits and downloads and so on. And it's also obvious to us in the correspondence and the contacts that we receive from people like yourselves who read the website and are interested in what we're saying and contact us through it. So we only have one goal, and that's to build our party as the party of the interests of the working population in the United States, as part of an international party of the working population, of the working class. So how long that's going to take, who knows? You know, the Bolshevik experience in Russia was that they went from being a rather small party, decimated by a split over the entry and support of different sections in World War One, to holding state power in a matter of 3 years over 1/6 of the Earth's surface. When economic and social crises develop, things can change very, very, very quickly. And the consciousness of millions of people can change very, very, very quickly. And we're trying to set the groundwork to make sure that when that happens, because it really is inevitable, that we are in the position to provide the leadership for a progressive way forward rather than some sort of degeneration into fascism and national chauvinism and other forms of reaction.
Well, John, we're going to wrap it up here in a few minutes. If you could tell us where our listeners could visit your website, and also if you have any final thoughts on anything that you want to cover that we have not covered in this last, we've been with you for almost an hour now.
Well, thank you. I guess I'm getting a little bit talked out, which is very difficult for a lawyer to ever admit.
Well, yeah, absolutely. You'd be the first to ever admit to that, actually, John.
Think of this as your closing argument.
Right.
But I really appreciate you having me on the show and allowing this alternative to be talked about on the airwaves and on the World Wide Web, which itself is a fantastic medium, and one that really reflects what has happened. Now we're in the 21st century, which is the global integration of production on a scale that's historically never been seen before. This globalization brings into sharp focus the necessity for a change and a break with this old system of nation states, each one sort of defending the interests of its own financial oligarchy and bourgeoisie, and one toward an international system where these wonderful productive forces, this incredible technology that has the potential to meet human needs worldwide on a scale that we've never imagined before, so that it can be harnessed for the social good of broad masses of people rather than used to destroy the planet ecologically and to protect profits in what has become really an obscene concentration of wealth in very few hands, and in the process eliminating the causes of imperialist war. So this is what we stand for, and anybody who agrees that this is a good way for the planet to go forward should contact us at wsws.org, the World Socialist website.
Very good. Thanks for joining us today. We really appreciate the last about 50 minutes you spent with us, John. And just to let you know, if I've done my job properly, I'm the kind of the somewhat engineer. We will have your interview posted on our website later today, and it'll also be on Radio for All in Indie Media. But you could find links at our website, which is www.ltobs.blogspot.com. So if you want to refer anybody to the interview, that's where you can send them. So thanks for joining us, and we really appreciate your time very much, John.
Yes, well, thank you very much.
Okay. Thank you.
Thanks.
You.
Bye. That was John Burton with the World Socialist website, WSWS.org, and also a political activist. And what's the actual correct, I don't want to butcher the name, what's the correct name of the party, Tom?
Socialist Equality Party.
Right, and he joined us today from his residence in Pasadena, California. And Mark, thanks for listening to us on Live 365. We hope that Mr. Burton answered the question you had for us, and I think he did answer the question and more.
Right. We sometimes ask the same question twice.
But
there's one thing, if you do have a comment to make, the line is now open, and you can call us, and we'll put you on the air, and you can say what you think.
Right, and our number here at KRBS is 530-534-1200. We're going to take a very brief musical break so we can reset for the last segment of our show, and Tom's signaling to me.
Yeah, I was wondering, you know, since we're drifting back towards the Gilded Age,
yes,
are we going to be saying 1-2-0-0? You
know, one,
the
two,
old way of saying zero?
Well, these years are the 0-0 years, aren't they, too? We're not in the teens yet, so these are the 0-0 years. You know, like Jethro Bodine, 0+0 is 0,
exactly.
Right? But you're listening to Left Turn on Bird Street, and we'll be back in just a moment.
It costs me a lot, but there's one thing that I've got. It's my man. It's my man. Cold or wet, tired you bet. All of this I'll soon forget. With my man, he's not much on looks, he's no hero out of books, but I love him. Yes, I love him. Two or three girls has he that he likes as well as me, but I love him. I don't know why I should. He isn't true. He beats me too. What can I do? Oh, my man, I love him so. He'll never know. All my life is just despair. But I don't care. When he takes me in his arms, the world is bright. All right. What's the difference if I say I'll go away when I know I'll come back on my knees someday? For whatever my man is, I'm his forevermore.
Listening to Left Turn on Bird Street, a little Billie Holiday music there, My Man, and actually, because that's a good song to segue into our next segment, because our My Man might be our president's, right? This is, after all...
Your man, maybe.
Yeah, not our man, but, you know, my man. We've only had men presidents. We're probably one of the... I think we're... You know, how many... You know, even England's has had a, you know, a female leader... You know,
you're talking about not the queen. You're talking about the prime minister.
Anyhow, you're listening to Left Turn on Bird Street. We're heard every other Saturday on KRBS 107.1 FM. And we're heard from 9 until 11 a.m. And we're also heard on some other fine stations. We're heard on KQRP 106.1 FM in Salida, California, WCRV 97.1 in Cherry Ridge, Pennsylvania, and WYQZ 96.7 Billton, Virginia. And so thank you very much for joining us. We really appreciate you spending some time. And as evidenced by our caller Mark on our last break, we're also heard by people outside of those areas via Live 365 on the internet. And you can find the Live 365 link on the KRBS website, which is radiobirdstreet.org. So we encourage you to listen to us, and we'll also have our program posted later today or possibly tomorrow on our website at www.ltobs.blogspot.com. So you have several different ways to listen to this program, and we encourage you to refer your friends to us, as Mark did.
Well, you know, when Mark called us,
yes, and
he was calling from Hollywood.
Hollywood.
You know how active my imagination is.
Yes.
I pictured him on a cell phone standing on a gold star in front of Grauman's Chinese Theater.
No, no, no. Mark was there after he got done. He's listening to us, and then he's talking to other people. Say, hey, have my people call your people, and we'll do lunch together sometime, right? Yeah, but thanks, Mark, for listening to us. That was really nice to hear from you. Call him from Hollywood, California. So as we sit here in Oroville on Saturday, it is, of course, President's Day weekend. And, of course, our other stations, when they hear this, will be past President's Day weekend. But with that in mind, Tom came across a very interesting story. So let me just read a little bit of it from you. It's from the News Dissector. And let's see, what's it say? I'll just read a little bit. Benedict Carey reports in the New York Times, all told, almost half of American presidents from 1789 to 1974 have suffered from a mental illness at some point in life, according to a recent analysis of biographical sources by psychiatrists at Duke University Medical Center. And more than half of those presidents, the study found, struggled with their symptoms, most often depression, while in office. The good doctor says, what is hopeful about this is that there is evidence that people can suffer from depression or other mental problems and still function at a presidential level, if not at their best, said Dr. Jonathan Davidson, who, along with Dr. Catherine Connor and Dr. Marvin Schwartz, that's some bad writing there, Tom.
Yes, we run into that all the time. You know, stealing all those scripts from other people, you have to run into those things.
God, that's irritating. Catalog symptoms from presidential papers and biographies and identify those disabling enough to qualify as disorders. They reported their findings in the current issue of the Journal of Nervous and Medical Disease. Okay, let's just read just a little bit more.
I was jotting it down a note to Dan,
right,
about this thing, because I added to this that now, Dan, what's wrong with that picture? First of all, notice that the study went from George Washington to Richard Nixon.
Yeah, why not George W. Bush?
It stopped
Ronald
short
Reagan
of evaluating any of the
or
presidents
Carter
on whom we have the most information to prove the theory. Or disprove it, not to mention being alive and able to sue them in court for comments made about them.
Right.
Not exactly courageous scholarship, is it?
No, not at all.
And I think they're setting up an alibi, is what they're doing, is that they're putting this article out so that Bush can say, crazy, sick, hey, all of them were. Destroying democracy? They all tried to. Why pick on me?
I'm no different than the rest, you know?
I'm no dumber than the others.
Yeah, right. Now, what's interesting is I wonder if they have any studies on vice presidents, because actually Bush is the vice president and Cheney really is the president, right?
Right. Well, Agnew, I believe, is still alive.
Oh, is that right?
Well, anyway, the... So it's just strange to me that, let's see, we have, we had a call coming in that kind of distracted us. Well, Dan, speaking of presidents and President Bush, there's a great story about overpriced cocktails.
Well,
why would that spring to mind?
No, wait a second. I thought the president didn't drink anymore.
Well, there have been reports of somebody seeing him tippling.
Oh, well, you know, before you get started on this story, let me. I'm just reminded of an encounter I had. Went to pick up my wife Jenny at work the other day, and I was waiting in the break room, and I was talking to one of the guys there, and somehow we got onto the subject of the price of booze. And I was, you know, reminiscing 30 years ago in Michigan when you were drinking age then was 18, believe it or not.
So that puts you at 12, right?
Right. Well, basically, you can establish yourself at a gin joint. But if you're 16 and can establish yourself at a gin joint, you are set. You are a made teenager.
Made man.
Made teenager. It's probably why they changed it back to 21. But, you know, in all seriousness, you could go. I was telling this guy who's about 30. I said, you could go into a bar and get a shell of beer for 50 cents.
Now you got to explain to people what a shell is.
A shell is like, about a 10-ounce glass.
In New York, they call them ponies.
Ponies. Yeah, okay, right. In Detroit, they call them shells, but it's a kind of a curved glass that goes up like that. It holds maybe 8 or 10 ounces. You could get a shot and a beer for actually a dollar.
In New York, they call it a ball and a beer.
Ball and
a
beer.
Ball at the top of the.
Right.
I have no experience in this, mind you.
Yeah, right. And other people in Detroit would actually call it a Polish martini, too. You know, shot in the beer.
They can't say that anymore.
They can't say that anymore. But
anyway, this article that I ran into comes from the Village Voice, and it's actually part two of a series they're running on overpriced cocktail Hall of Shame. Now, when I was living in New York and going to places that sold cocktails, Mike Malkin, great place up on 86th Street, uh-huh. I believe it was, or somewhere in that neighborhood. I can't really remember, you know. But anyway, the a cocktail, martini, shot of rye, whatever, was a dollar.
Right.
So this leaped out at me. Karina Zappi is writing this from a February 2nd issue of the Village Voice. Subtitles Liquid City. Love that.
Liquid City.
They did a story about the price of cocktails, and they got some responses afterwards, so hence part two. It says, when we asked readers last week to email their own experiences with bars that serve absurdly overpriced cocktails, it went way beyond the $14 martini. I nearly fell over hit the
$14?
Ground.
$14? You can buy a whole bottle of...
Yeah, that's my question. Why are they even bothering?
You can buy three bottles of cheap booze.
But you can't get a bottle of vodka, go home and meet girls.
Yeah, right. That's true.
And we agree.
Well, wait. You can on the internet nowadays, Tom. Come on.
Oh, that's right. There is a girl at home.
Right.
And we agree. Why should a well drink with a $5 a bottle vodka cost $9? Our boozing colleagues at City Search in New York Online even wrote in, sick of shelling, as they call it your way. Oh, no, they mean the other kind of shelling out for another $10 rum and Coke. Also, extra demerits go to Rooftop and other outside bars that serve their costly cocktails in plastic cups. Granted, there may be some legal reasons for this, something about the throwing of glass tumblers from the 10th stories up. Maybe that's it.
Yeah, that's a good reason to me.
I'll do it, particularly
if you're not on the ground floor.
And being shoved behind it. Anyway, in which case our rejoinder is that nothing makes us want to hurt foamy bud more than coughing up $50 for 3 dozen mojitos, whatever those are, in glorified Dixie cups. Brothers and sisters, we've all been had. Anyway, these are the comments that come in. I found some of these interesting. Guy writes in, this is Daniel Moore, writes in, I was at old favorite Milk and Honey for the first time in a while a few nights ago, and their cocktail prices have rocketed up to, if I remember correctly, $15.
Woo!
If I'm not mistaken, Jeez. They started years ago at $8. Well, even that's outrageous.
That's a lot of money for a drink.
Then went to $11. They weren't even using real absinthe. Well, you can't buy real absinthe anymore in the Sazerac that night. I guess Sasha, this must have been a Russian bar or something,
yeah.
Wised up when he saw the customers at Double Seven digging into their Blahnik budgets for apple juice. Another comment comes from about Believe Lounge. I have to submit this puppy to the Hall of Shame. I know, it's $12, $1 too short of their margin for whether it's too expensive. Had to be at least $13, apparently. But if you pick a runner-up, this should be it, man. And that was must have been cut off. Anyway, the Stanton Social, that's the name of a bar, shocked the bejesus out of me.
Wait, Stanton Social, that sounds like a mafia hangout.
And it's not a political party.
Yeah, right.
Stanton Social, a bar, shocked the bejesus out of me, this person writes, with its overpriced martinis. Sure, the celebs hang there, but still, it's the Lower East Side, for crying out loud. The Kitty Chai serves for brunch, $4 for coffee, and martinis start at 14. What do you do to a martini? It's just vermouth and a very little vermouth, the less the better, and gin or vodka. What do you mean?
Wait, let me butt in here for a minute. You're right. I love martinis. I've loved them since I've been 18, legally. I really do. And, you know, to me, I've always been a gin martini. There's two types of martinis, or four types, if you want to get technical. There's gin martinis, vodka martinis, and there's dry or extra dries. You know they have, like, things like called chocolate martinis now, Tom? It's not even a martini. A martini is supposed to be a good, stiff drink. These are like, you know, you might as well be drinking some chocolate milk. Chocolate martinis, I swear, I kid you not. But go ahead.
Anyway, just to give you a couple more, not to work this thing to death, but...
Oh, let's work it to death and go have a martini afterwards.
Beth Bonnet writes in saying to the Village Voice, how about Kush Lounge on the Lower East Side? The hookahs, whatever they are, run $30, but the cocktails are still all $15. Don't get me wrong, they're good and strong, but $15 good? No way. I would definitely add, another writer says, the rooftop of the Delancey, where a Jack and Coke, I guess that's Jack Daniels and Coke, was $9 and served in a plastic cup.
God.
There's one down here I'm trying to get to, the PM Martini at PM, and that's the name of the place, in the Meatpacking District. Now that's sort of down towards Canal Street, but over to the, if you're looking at it from a map, it's over on the right side.
It's a real, real Lower East Side, right?
Very, very lower. You know,
right.
Way down from the Hope, what they call Soho, which is south
of Houston.
Houston Street there. Okay. I remember, I was there. The Meatpacking District is $15 for something involving fruity stuff and boozy stuff and a flower, likely to contain a top-secret recipe of Capri Sun and Grey Goose.
Capri Sun?
I don't know. That's
the little juice things you put in your kids' lunches.
Oh, really? Yeah.
It costs about a dime a piece, you know, if you get them at the really Winco.
Maybe you can charge the kids $15.
I think I will. Billy Joy, get ready to shell out for your lunches now.
I admit, the writer says, it tastes pretty good, but most of it, will end up spilled all over the crowds of sleazy paper people in the shiny outfits as they scoff at you for dressing in 100% cotton. You might consider doing an article on places that engage in the practice of double dipping. This is a huge pet peeve of mine, this writer says. It's when a bar or restaurant charges additional sales tax on their alcoholic drinks. For example, if I am at the bar at Mercer Kitchen, which could also be a nominee, come to think of it, and I look at the blackboard, it says a certain glass of wine is $9. However, when I get the bill, the drink is almost a full dollar more because they have added sales tax to the cost of the drink. A dollar? Was that a 10% sales tax?
Yeah. More than 10.
A tax that is supposed to be included. That extra money goes into their pocket. In my opinion, should be represent tax fraud. Besides, Mercer Kitchen, other places that I know engage in this are the Odeon, Edwards, and pretty much all Jean Georges restaurants. You know, and this is the last. I got to really throw this one in. The bar is at the top of Hotel Gansevoort in the Meatpacking District also. Should make your list. I ordered 2 Amstel Lights and a vodka tonic. It came out to $32.
Jeez.
And all were served in plastic cups.
Golly.
It was $9 each for the Amstels. That's a bottle of beer.
Yeah.
You know, and $19 for the vodka tonic with house vodka. Can you believe that?
Jeez.
After we finished our drinks, we exited promptly. If we could have had parachutes, we could have got out of there sooner. It was a bad recommendation from a coworker who makes more than I do. Anyway, the things have come to... You say the world's going to hell. I say it is in a basket.
I mean, this is proof of it. I mean, you can't go into a bar with $5 and have a couple of drinks nowadays. What is this world coming to, Tom? I mean,
well,
really?
I think they're just trying to chase the riffraff out of New York so that it can all be... Fifth Avenue and Park Avenue.
Now, actually, let's take this from the perspective of a gold digger. Gold digger is going to go there because she's going to say, anybody can afford drinks in here to buy two or three drinks, three or four drinks, five drinks. It's $100. It's a single right there. So
this is an
idea.
It's kind of a
elimination, if you like you said.
This is an idea. You know, in New York, there are people who will set up little illegal gambling operations in their apartments.
Yeah.
You can become a member of the club and go there and gamble. They should probably have people opening up bars in their apartments. You know, you come and get cheap drinks or less expensive.
If I'm not mistaken, those are called blind pigs, if I'm not mistaken, right?
No, those are the ones that stay open after 2 a.m. or I guess they're 24 hours
yeah,
now.
Blind pigs. Tom, that's an idea. Maybe that's how we can fund our website, is we go to New York and open up a blind... Well, I shouldn't be talking about this on the air. The FCC is liable to come and get us, right? We can't say that, can we? Can we say that?
What?
Set up a blind pig? No, we better not.
I have a book called that. We could say that, write a book.
You know? Yeah, write a book called Blind Pig. You're listening to Left Turn on Bird Street on KRBS 107.1 FM in Oroville, California. Our program, as I've said before, and I'm going to say it again, it's heard on three other very good, excellent radio stations. KQRP 106.1 FM in Salida, California. WCRB 97.1 FM in Cherry Ridge, Pennsylvania. And WYQZ at 96.7 FM in Bealeton, Virginia. Thanks for joining us today. We appreciate you spending some time. As I was saying, we broadcast from... KRBS in Oroville, California, and our show is heard every other Saturday from live every other Saturday from 9 until 11 a.m. Pacific Standard Time, and our show is also broadcast live from the RadioBirdStreet.org website on Live 365. So if you're listening to us somewhere around the world, thanks for joining us. We really appreciate it. Tom, what else you got on your stack?
Oh, well, you know, I've got some really short items that just astounded me. I was looking for serious news, and I couldn't find any. All I could find out is the world going crazy. This is a, you've sort of probably heard that Cheney was busy shooting people. But
Tom, I think I mentioned, they told me at work, they wanted me, I won a grand prize. What is it? You're going to go on a hunting trip with Dick Cheney. Go ahead.
Well,
sorry.
Anyway, they've... this is from The Guardian, which
fine
I found
publication
through,
in England.
Right, that's in it used to be in Manchester. Now it's actually in London. And I got it through the Age in Australia that picked it up. But this is a Julian Borger. I hope I'm saying that right. He's a Washington correspondent for Guardian. The headline is this: Shotgun Victim Says Sorry to Cheney. Now. This is the world turned upside down, Victim apologizes to murderer for being in the way.
as in the way of your quail there, Dick.
The
surprised Dick didn't tell him to go, himself.
Oh, sure.
Like he did to Patrick Leahy. He said, hey, go yourself.
This is what the Republican lawyer shot by Dick Cheney in a hunting accident in Texas last weekend has emerged from hospital and apologized to the U.S. vice president for all the trouble the shooting has caused.
Oh, God.
Harry Whittington, who suffered a minor heart attack when a shotgun pellet lodged near his heart, absolved Mr. Cheney of any responsibility. How many Secret Service agents standing there around there with guns drawn forced him to do this? Make a good suggestion.
Well, or that, or, they're missing, $32 billion in Iraq. How many satchels of money did they say? Oh, you got to say this, and this money is yours. Go ahead.
What was that thing said in Godfather where Marlon Brando tells him, make it...
Make them an offer they can't refuse.
Exactly. Anyway, so much for that one. Also, this is getting out of hand. 10 killed as cartoon protesters target Italy.
Oh.
Okay? Why this is interesting, we've been hearing that. This is just sad that it's happening.
I mean, even before we came in this morning, I was checking the internets, and was this one in Libya?
Yep.
Okay, yeah, okay, in Libya, and there was like some other in Pakistan yesterday.
Right, but this, well, it happened in Libya, in Benghazi.
Uh-huh.
But this is our story comes from London, or from Rome, and this is what it says. Italy's far-right reforms minister, Roberto Calderoli, was yesterday resisting calls to resign following deadly clashes in Libya over cartoons of the Prophet Muhammad that he had made into T-shirts. About 10 people were killed on Friday when they tried to storm the Italian consulate in Benghazi in eastern Libya. This can you imagine this distributed T-shirts with that in a Muslim country? Free T-shirt with every order of extra pizza.
Not very bright. Not very bright.
Anyway, here's the wrinkle in this that amazed me. Prime Minister Silvio Berlusconi publicly demanded that Mr. Calderoli step down on Friday. He does not have the constitutional power to force a minister out of office. The episode has embarrassed Mr. Berlusconi ahead of April elections. It isn't that 10 people were killed.
Right.
It's that it was bad for his election possibilities. I mean, this is another reverse of logic
world gone wild.
And I don't know if you follow Arianna Huffington.
Occasionally, I read her blog.
You know, when I first encountered her, I thought that, she actually turned out to be a very intelligent, very smart, and a good writer.
Yes.
And terrific sense of humor.
Yes.
And, you know, women, it has been proven by science, don't often have senses of humor.
I'm not going there, Tom.
Some do. And when they do, it's good. Molly Ivins, you know, they happen to, but it's not often. This is an excerpt from
Tom said that, not me.
Okay.
I like Lily Tomlin. Come on.
Rarely.
Ernestine the snotty.
Matter of fact, if there was a crown or an Academy Award for women with senses of humor, Lily Tomlin, she'd get it. It's the most acerbic of them all.
Yeah. Anyhow,
anyway,
Tom said that, not me.
Then this article this is an excerpt from Arianna Huffington's article from February 10th. I read it before, but I found it again today. She went to London and went to a stage production of George Orwell's 1984. It was adapted by Michael Gene Sullivan and directed by Tim Robbins. You know him.
Okay?
And was struck by the ways that Big Brother uses fear and perpetual war to keep the citizens of Oceania under control, and especially how that fear effectively blots out memory. She quotes a line from the play. His memory, writes Orwell of his rebellious hero, that would be Mr. Goldstein, was not satisfactorily under control. Memory, satisfactorily under control, is a perfect description of the mindset that allows Bush and Cheney to repeatedly lie to the American people and get away with it, thanks to the constant fear-mongering again and again. Orwell also shows how a frightened people will look to the strongest and most confident to save and protect them. As Goldstein says in the play, and this is the one I like, is even the humblest, most industrious citizen is expected to be an ignorant fanatic whose prevailing moods are fear, hatred, adulation, and triumph, regardless of his own suffering. In other words, the mentality appropriate to a state of war. And being at war, and therefore in danger, makes them the handing over of all power to a small caste seem the natural, unavoidable condition of survival. And there you have it. The Big Brothers and the Bush White House, Huffington says, bang the fear gong like clockwork. Early in the week, or that week, which is a couple weeks ago, the administration took some hits on its NSA warrantless wiretapping, and with even Republicans like Senator Arlen Specter, I have some suspicions about him in particular. He's the one that crafted the the Kennedy assassination.
Right.
Right, yeah. Anyway, and that's how long these guys can be in office.
That he came up with, the magic bullet theory.
Yeah, right. Anyway, but he was a staff member at that time, I believe. And
right.
Representative Heather Wilson raising
Heather.
Doubts. Heather?
Heather.
What did I say, Heather?
He said Heather.
Oh, no, it's Heather. Yeah,
Heather.
And before the week was out, there was the president offering up details of shoe bombs and young men from Southeast Asia meeting with Osama bin Laden and preparing to attack L.A. In 1984, the unseen enemy keeps shifting from Eurasia to East Asia and back again.
Right. Well, that's the basic ingredient of the Bush administration is fear, fear, fear. And when you're in doubt about what to do, fear, you know, bring out the fear tool. Now, that's all they do. It's a excuse me, it's nonstop.
And this last thing for me, at least, bird flu likely to reach UK, that's Britain,
right,
as disease kills French duck.
Oh, yeah. No.
Now, that's a headline I like.
Yeah, French duck.
What is a French duck?
One
does
that
it speak with an accent?
What is it, foie gras?
No, that's right.
Right. You know, yeah. It's goose liver, actually.
Yeah, this is in the evening news in the UK, which is Britain, as it used to be known as England. The government has warned that bird flu is likely to reach UK shores following confirmation that a duck in France died of the disease. That's moving our way fast.
Yes, it is moving our way fast. But, you know, I have my suspicions on, I mean, not to minimize that, but, you know, the Bush administration has even used that tactic to, from time to time, to divert attention to what's going on. The avian flu, they had a big push, I don't know, it was about a year ago, somewhere in there, where they, that just another tool in their fear factor arsenal. Well, I like that, fear factor arsenal. That's what the Bush administration employs.
And not only that, but there were some vaccine or inoculation that was made not available or wasn't produced, so it couldn't be available for what was it? It wasn't the bird flu, but it's something.
Right, it was a flu virus last year.
Right, yeah.
Not this flu season.
And this
flu
is another thing. How stupid could they be? They didn't provide for making of that vaccine. Well, it's not stupid. It's smart because if you want the poor who can't afford the shot die and clear out the Park Avenue and Fifth Avenue, that's what you do.
Well, actually, it goes even deeper than that. As you may recall, they use that, they said, well, the problem is that we don't have any domestic production of this, and it's because the liability laws are such, so therefore, let's pass laws that will exempt them from lawsuits. I mean, that was what that whole deal was about, and that's going back, I don't know, a year, year and a half ago, whenever that was, but...
Yeah, but... I could see right through it.
Oh, I
could
see right through
it. And I'm not the smartest guy in the world. Why can't some others?
Either am I. Well, you know, this is the whole thing. It's like, let's just, I know we're running out of time here, but going back to the Cheney incident where he shot the guy, let's just say, you know, I like how they're using.
I shot the sheriff.
Yeah, all these euphemisms. He shot the dude. You know, he blasted him. He blasted the old geezer, put him in the hospital. They didn't release it for 24 hours. I mean, there's so much more to this story. It doesn't appear to be going away immediately, although I think its legs are getting a little wobbly now. But the part that's really irritating, or I shouldn't say really irritating, it's par for the course, when Cheney finally does face the music such as it was, where does he go? Does he go on NPR? Does he go on even CNN or CBS? No, he goes to Fox News, you know? I mean, you know, where Brit Hume throws softball questions at him. He doesn't hold a news
provides
conference.
Provides him the answers
yeah,
in the question.
You know, it's just unbelievable. But, you know, to me, it's, you know, the thing with the Cheney thing is that it took a couple days for the thing to get legs. But, you know, had this been any other administration, man, this guy would have been strung and quartered already, you know. And this guy is just, he just kind of disappears from sight, and yet he's pulling all the strings.
Now, imagine this headline and think where this would have gone in a slightly earlier time. Clinton guns down, neighbors barking dog.
Yeah, right. But one last thing about Cheney, you know, and this is what struck me. I did a little research the other night, and apparently Dick Cheney has had, when he was a young man, a couple DUIs. So he has had some experience with drunk driving and driving under the influence. And Tom, you're
that's
a little
bit... because he could afford the $15 a martini.
Exactly, right, from Halliburton, from the billions missing. But I want to end the show maybe on this last thought. I got my driver's license in 1974, and they had drunk driving laws there. And if somebody got pulled over for drunk driving, a lot of times back then the cops would say, "How far are you from home?" "I'm, you know, five blocks. Just drive home and don't drive anymore." You know, they were as cops can be.
This would be before they started wearing combat gear,
right? And, you know, to get the a drunk state. Driving, and this was in the early '60s. To get a drunk driving back in the '70s, and I can only imagine much less in the early '60s. You had to have been blasted. I mean, really, really, really blasted. Not a little bit drunk where you're in that 0.08 range. You had to have been blasted. So just keep that in mind. You know, Dick Cheney and George Bush, for that matter, when you got drunk driving up through the 70s and even into the 80s, you were really, really blasted.
I told you I have an active imagination. I can just see that stop. Please step out of the car. The car you're in. That one, yes, yes. This foot and then that foot. Come on out.
Well, thanks for joining us today. You're listening to, or you've been listening to, whether you like it or not, Left Turn on Bird Street. We are broadcasted from KRBS 107.1 in beautiful downtown Oroville, the city of gold. Thanks for joining us. KRBS is a nonprofit, all-volunteer community radio station. And, you know, I probably should have read this at the beginning, but I can do it now.
And still save our...
And still save our hide. It's the disclaimer. The opinions voiced on this program do not necessarily reflect the views or opinion of KRBS, its staff, volunteers, board of underwriters, board of directors, or, most importantly, underwriters. But they should.
But they should. And if I have my way next time we're on, they will.
And ditto for our other three stations. They don't necessarily reflect their views, but they should.
And we would also like to thank Mr. John Burton,
yes,
the Pasadena attorney that spoke today for WSWS.org, the World Socialist website, and for the Socialist Equality Party. He was a great guest. He actually knew what he was talking about, as opposed to some of our other guests.
Right.
And ourselves.
Or ourselves. And last but not least, we want to thank Michael DeVera, the composer of the Left Turn on Bird Street theme music. And we're going to go out with some of the brooding music from the Left Turn on Bird Street theme. Thanks for joining us, and we'll see you in a couple weeks.